Hi, I'm Dr. Casey Mixon, Assistant Professor at Valdosta State University's Psychology, Counseling, and Family Therapy Department, and Project Director for the Military Families Learning Network Family Development Team. Along with team members Barry Sobelson and Jason Jowers, we invite you to join us for our anchored podcast conversations. We started this podcast to support and inspire those connected to military families. Each episode focuses on real-life struggles and practical solutions to lessen harmful ripple effects and promote connection through stories of healing and hope. We invite you to sit back, relax, and get anchored with us. Just want to give you, our listeners, a heads up. We started recording the podcast with Josh Goldberg on a bright and sunny day. However, around 15 minutes into our conversation, a rather large storm came rolling in, so you're going to hear rain and thunder in the background. I personally think it adds a bit of audio ambiance, but we'll let you be the judge. Thanks in advance for your patience if it is a bit distracting. So today's episode will be focused on the topic of post-traumatic growth. We will be speaking with Josh Goldberg, the executive director of the Boulder Crest Institute for Post-Traumatic Growth. In his role as executive director, Josh is responsible for leading the development and delivery of training, technology, research and evaluation, and social and policy changes based on the science of post-traumatic growth. Josh is also the co-author of the May 1st, 2018 released book, Struggle Well, Thriving in the Aftermath of Trauma, which he co-wrote with Mr. Ken Falk, who's the chairman and founder of Boulder Crest. And in their book, Goldberg and Falk address the topic of post-traumatic growth and highlight actionable strategies for those who are struggling to make peace with their past, to live in the present, and planning for a great future. So we welcome you, Josh, and appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For the listeners who are not familiar with the concept of post-traumatic growth, can you explain what we mean by that?
Sure. Post-traumatic growth, and the actual words were coined by Dr. Richard Tedeschi and his colleague Lawrence Calhoun, who were two clinical psychologists at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, in 1995. And in the shortest form of it, post-traumatic growth could be considered that Nietzschean idea that what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. And what it really describes, and it's a science that's about 30 years old, is the process by which people take things and loss and trauma and other really difficult life experiences and use those to transform their lives in meaningful ways. And people who experience post-traumatic growth often report that in the aftermath of such events and such process, that they find that their relationships are much more meaningful and deeper, that they have a greater sense of all the new possibilities that life can offer, but they have a better understanding of why they're on earth and what they're meant to do with their time and more of a greater focus on service, that they have more gratitude about the gifts that they have in their life and a different sense of priorities about what does and doesn't matter to them, and that they have a greater appreciation of their own strength and their capacity to withstand anything.
And at what point did you learn about the concept of post-traumatic growth? Like what perked your curiosity and got you interested in this concept?
So our journey really started with our founder, you mentioned, my co-author, Ken Falk, who is the chairman and founder of Boulder Crest. And when Boulder Crest Retreat Virginia first opened in September of 2013, it was the first wellness center that was privately funded and solely dedicated to combat veterans and their families. And when we opened, we had two missions. The first was family rest and reconnection, which still exists to this day. Combat veterans and their families, as well as Gold Star families, can come for free and spend 2 to 7 nights in our beautiful cabins here in Virginia or in Arizona. And the second thing we wanted to do was we recognized that a lot of these families and individuals were struggling with different types of mental health challenges. And so we invited a range of nonprofits who were under $1 million in revenue and for whom accommodations and venues were really hard to come by or very expensive to run their programs. And we watched what they did and we observed and we saw some decent things and some less decent things. And it really provoked Ken's interest in this topic of post-traumatic stress disorder and some of these other mental health challenges. And in particular, Ken was a bomb disposal technician. And in 2004, when the first EOD tech got hurt in Iraq, he was asked to go to the hospital. And it led him to spend a lot of times with severely wounded service members in the hospital and to bear witness to their strength and their capability. And he saw people who lost all of their limbs who continued to use this and use their loss and experience and not pity themselves, but actually really move forward into the life that they were meant to have moving forward. And the question that Ken had was, why is it that some people go through really difficult times or loss or physical injury and end up better off and others don't? And he started meeting with a range of clinicians around the country and around the world, experts in the areas of trauma, military psychology, post-traumatic stress disorder, and a range of other things. And what he heard was disheartening. He heard that, in essence, war was so severe that it essentially broke people and that there was very little that could be done and that the majority of the treatments that focused on symptom relief or reduction were as good as we could get. And that didn't resonate with him because it wasn't true to what he had seen in those hospital rooms. And then on that journey, he was introduced to Dr. Tedeschi in Charlotte and started having a conversation with Rich. And Rich described post-traumatic growth and described his work. And a lot of the PTG science came from bereaved parents, which is obviously a tremendous and horrible loss to experience and lose your own child.
Right.
And as Rich described this, Ken was like, that sounds much more consistent with my experiences and also with the military culture. And the question to Rich was, you've observed and studied this phenomenon. The question is, can we actually cultivate and facilitate it? And I was with Ken at the time having these discussions, and that's what we set out to do with Rich, which was, how do we actually take this thing that we know happens organically for some people and not for others and help people achieve it? And that was back in really 2014, 2015, and it's been a truly incredible, fulfilling, and challenging journey ever since.
And by that time, Dr. Tedeschi and Dr. Calhoun had already had about 3 decades worth of research on post-traumatic growth, or about that.
They have.
It wasn't just we have an idea, now let's go see if we can implement it. It's like, no, this is a substantial amount of information that we've collected and learned about. So that's really interesting that they bridged the gap and applied it to a military culture. So my understanding of post-traumatic growth too is that there tends to be 5 general areas. And just for our listeners, one, you know, when a major crisis develops or a major life, traumatic life event, that there's new opportunities can emerge from the struggle. Maybe a secondary area, change in relationship with others, an increased sense of one's own strength. This idea that if I live through that, I can face anything, and a greater appreciation for life in general, and a deeper understanding of spiritual self, or a deepening or a significant change in a belief system that an individual may have. Am I on the right track with my understanding of post-traumatic growth?
You are, and there's really 2 facets to it. So what you just described are what they call the domains, or what some of the people here at BoulderFest call the indicators of growth. And one of the most beautiful things about what Rich and Lawrence did was to really be witnesses to those who had gone through this process, as opposed to trying to really, I don't know, corporatize or overly academicize what they saw. And they allowed the voices and the words of the people who had been through these experiences to shape what they understood. And so when they listened to all of the commentary and words of the people who have been on this journey from all of these different ailments, from paralysis and losing limbs to losing children to losing a spouse, they listened to all of the things these people tell them about all of the growth that they had experienced, and they bucketed them into 5 areas like you described.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of post-traumatic growth are these phases that aren't mechanistic in any way. You don't do 1, then 2, then 3, but these phases that people go through as they do it. And I want to come back to your point from earlier. There is a tremendously robust body of evidence that speaks to what post-traumatic growth is and looks at post-traumatic growth in different environments and circumstances and stories. But what had never happened, and I was sitting with Rich talking about this past weekend, is they never really tried to catalyze it. They simply studied the phenomenon. And we sometimes call it what we do here applied post-traumatic growth, which is we took the theory that Rich and Lawrence had developed over the course of these many years, And we started to try to figure out how do you bring it into practice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the major innovation that we've been collaborating on is taking somebody who thinks that their life is now inherently diminished or limited because of their struggle and injected hope and possibility, but also a pathway to go from deep struggle to profound strength. And in so many ways, when you talk about core ingredients of the journey of when you're struggling, hope is probably the number one thing that's missing, mm-hmm. and that is critical, which is that there's a belief that actually, not in spite of this, but because of these experiences you've had, there's something more out there for you, which keeps people yearning and curious and growing and seeking, as opposed to rigid and stuck. And that's why, to us, it's such a meaningful idea. And then the application of that, of course, is what allows you to go from point A to point B.
So walk us through, if someone's interested in being involved in Boulder Crest from their struggling, they want to learn how to struggle well, if you will. And so what does that look like? Is there an application process? Do they have to be referred? And then what does that journey look like?
Sure. So I mentioned that we have this Family Rest and Reconnection program, which we spend about 40 to 50% of our calendar year on. And then where we used to host external programs, we now have our own range of programs, which we call PATH. And our PATH programs are post-traumatic growth-based programs. And we have Warrior PATH, which is for individual combat veterans, as well as first responders. We have Family PATH that we're developing right now. So we've done 3 pilots. We'll do 5 more this summer. And then we'll create a curriculum. And the curriculum is a student guide, an instructor guide, robust program evaluation, a journal, a syllabus, a schedule, kind of everything you would need to scale this to other places. We probably next year will start work on our couples PATH program. And then the other program we want to work on is we call caregiver PATH, which is an individualized program for essentially spouses of service members and veterans. And so those programs, the Warrior PATH 1 is an 18-month program that begins with 7 days on the ground at one of our locations for what is a very intensive and immersive program. Mm-hmm. About 74 hours of training, not treatment, but training in post-traumatic growth that you experience. And it's highly experiential. It does mirror some of the best practices of military training. It's done in cohorts of between 6 to 8 people. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's over 18 months. And so the student guide and some of the other readings like Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, mm-hmm. Stories of the Hanoi Hilton come into play. And then we're building an app with Accenture Federal Services called MyPath, which also supports this journey. Our Family PATH program is 5 days on the ground. And once we get that, we'll figure out exactly how long it will be in terms of ongoing support and training and accountability.
And the Family PATH, you're piloting in both locations, in Virginia and in Arizona?
Yeah. So we now have Boulder Crest Retreat in Virginia and Arizona. And in Arizona, it's about 45 minutes outside of Tucson, and they're both beautiful and idyllic properties. We'll do Family PATH at both locations. And generally, I would suppose that Family PATH will be run during summer months just because of availability of family.
Right.
Those programs, we cover all costs, travel, and everything else. And the other part of the PATH programs is important. So you asked about eligibility. Mm-hmm. So in essence, if you're interested, you can email us. Email program@bouldercrestretreat.org. And you can say that you're interested in a family program, a Warrior PATH program. We have a 48-hour response rate, usually at maximum, in order to get back to you to kind of have an initial discussion and fill out some inquiry forms. And what we're looking for are people who are seeking a better life, right, who are trying to get to a better place but don't necessarily have the tools or the practices or the ability to get there, people mm-hmm. who feel stuck, who are struggling. And it doesn't really matter. The reason we use the term struggle is because it could be anxiety, it could be depression, it could be PTSD, it could be suicidal ideation. Whatever label or struggle you have mm-hmm. is much less important than where you're trying to go. And we believe we can train folks, and we have trained countless folks, to make that journey from deep struggle to profound strength. And the best part of this, and this is the one thing we didn't mention about post-traumatic growth, is post-traumatic growth is an inherently democratic process. And what I mean by that is that it's not reliant on experts and people who've studied in school. It's actually people who've lived the experiences and who've gone through their own post-traumatic growth. And that, in fact, in some of the anecdotal work that Rich has done, it suggests that the people who are best able to help another is someone who's gone through that. And so I've been through my own journey, which is detailed in our book, Struggle Well. My own journey, my own experiences with thinking that maybe suicide was the best option for me. And Ken's been through, lost his mom when he was 7 years old. and been through a lot of other experiences, is that we recognize and understand this journey from the inside out. And it's why our teams of who deliver it include combat veterans who've walked that road, civilians who've walked that road, and then a mental health professional who's also walked that road. Mm-hmm. And so it's all about sort of this mutuality of experience that life is challenging, it's filled with struggle, and the only question is, can you learn to struggle well, or do you struggle poorly? And we obviously prefer the former, and that's what we focus on training people to do.
Right. And I do want to talk about the book Struggle Well, but before we get into that, did I hear you say that there are opportunities to train helping professionals to learn the PATH program and be facilitators of this?
Yes. So we have a few next steps. And one of the things we did in May of last year, we acquired Arizona. And in November, we opened. And one of the things that created was a need internally to have an organization focused on quality assurance, on research, on curriculum development. And we also wanted to expand Warrior PATH in particular to start with, to more locations. So we're working with partners in a range of locations around the country, Florida and Georgia, Washington State, upstate New York, Texas, Colorado, to name a few. And we are in the market for partners who are interested in delivering PATH programs in their locale. Mm-hmm. And the other part of that is what we'll launch in September is called the Boulder Crest Institute for Post-Traumatic Growth, which is what I'll be running. And what we want to focus on there is both training folks to deliver these programs, which I kind of define as the what we do part, mm-hmm. but also training folks, including clinicians, mental health professionals, and others, in what we know, which mm-hmm. is this advanced science of post-traumatic growth.
Right.
And that's the subject of our ongoing work with Dr. Zdesky and Dr. Mm-hmm. Moore and others, is how do we use all of our experience applying this, Rich's experience for decades studying it, and help people understand more about what it looks like, because post-traumatic growth isn't mutually exclusive with anything. You can be a prolonged exposure practitioner, you can practice cognitive processing therapy, you can do equine therapy, but you can be informed by a philosophy of post-traumatic growth
right.
rather than one of, say, post-traumatic stress. And so that's the next step for us, is how do we scale what we've learned and what we're doing at the same time? And certainly, if folks are interested in that, you can click on my name on the Boulder Crest website. You can email me at josh@bouldercrestretreat.org. But we're building those training programs now to get this to more people, because you know our mission is to ensure that this community, which we believe is predisposed to post-traumatic growth, has the ability to access and achieve it.
Right. Well, let's dive into Struggle Well, Thriving in the Aftermath of Trauma. And again, it's written by Josh Goldberg and Ken Falk. One of the quotes in the book's excerpt relays, by embracing the struggle rather than fighting it, you can stop surviving and start thriving. And that's a pretty powerful statement, and one that may not be very easily achieved. You also talk about how sharing stories is a key step in moving beyond harmful byproducts of struggle. Are there stories that you'd be willing to share with our audience today where you've seen those positive results? I know you talked a little bit about your own experience and about Ken Falk's experience of this positive results, but are there other stories that you can share with our audience?
Sure, and I'll cover kind of both things you said, because okay. the first thing you talked about is that quote that speaks to the inevitability of struggle.
Right.
And all of our lives are sine waves. They're filled with ups and downs. In my own life, I've had ups and you know done well and graduated with honors at college, and I've had downs of getting divorced and leading down this sort of this terrible rabbit hole. And so we're not masochists. We don't believe you should look for it or seek it out, but we do believe that struggle will, in its own way, find us. And often our capacity to deal with it is based on our level of strength and our training. And so for me, I tell people, I was trained to be smart, not strong. That was the focus of my upbringing, and I was good at being smart. But when my mind started turning on me, when I started to struggle, I didn't really have what I needed to be able to get through it. And so as a civilian who has no military experience, I encountered veterans on my journey, and they were the ones who helped me find the strength inside of myself that I needed. And so what we believe is, if you recognize and sort of understand that struggle and things will occur in your life, you really have two choices. And this really goes to some of Zdesky's work. One choice is to say, why me? And it's assuming this almost a victim-like posture of acting as though there's some sort of karmic punishment entailed in what you're going through. And if you do that, you will get stuck, and you will be unable to move forward in a productive way. And you often engage in what they call counterfactual thinking, which is, I wish this never happened, or if this never happened. And that doesn't actually allow you to in some way accept it mm-hmm. and move through it.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side of that is this idea of asking why. And over the course of thousands of years, from the Book of Job and you know, the stories of every organized religion to books like Viktor Frankl, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. people have asked that question, why? What am I meant to learn from this? And when you do that, when you go down that journey, you start to be able to experience things. And one of our favorite stories in that vein is that which is written by the author of our foreword to our book, which is a retired Captain Charlie Plum,
uh-huh.
who spent 2,103 days in the Hanoi Hilton, which probably felt like 2,000 years. And Charlie speaks about that. And their story, for anyone who's interested in post-traumatic growth in action, the story of the men who were in the Hanoi Hilton, the 591 men, is an incredible story of post-traumatic growth. So that's the first part of it. The second part is you mentioned about the stories. And I think one of the things that happens when we struggle is our life becomes very chaotic and disorganized. And one of the biggest contributions that Rich and Lawrence made to the world isn't just that they injected hope in the world of trauma, which is normally we think trauma and we think bad things. And what they said is there's another side of the story. That was important. But what was also important is their definition of the word trauma. And the Greek word trauma means wound. But what Butch and Lawrence looked at was this idea that the reason why trauma is so destabilizing is that it disrupts your core beliefs about yourself, what you think is possible, who you are, mm-hmm. about the people around you, and about the world. And the world is not a fair place, it's not a safe place, those sorts of things. And when we talk about symptoms, like the normal PTSD symptoms of arousal and hypervigilance and these sorts of things, those are responses to the destruction of those belief systems. And so when we talk about telling your story, it's an effort to actually try to make sense of your narrative in a way that organizes it, that helps you make sense of your experiences in the world and of yourself so that you can move forward. And that's why it's so important. And so we look at and very much believe that we're a pattern of our conditioning and our training and our experiences. So when you ask people to look back and think about military training and experiences, whether you're a service member or a spouse, because it's a different set of training, but it is training nonetheless, and you develop a range of abilities that are constructive in some environments and destructive in others. And so when you talk and look about that, you actually start to look at your story with an objective view. You can be like, oh, so that's why I do what I do. And if I don't want to do that, this is what I need to do instead.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin to regain control over your life. Mm-hmm. And you're living life and life's not living you. And so, you know, I'm always mindful and a little bit reluctant to tell other people's story, which is one of the choices we made in our book, was to focus on our own. But the stories of folks who come here are time and again of people who had a difficult upbringing, in some ways incredibly traumatic upbringing, and found their way into the military, of course, in pursuit of service and commitment to the nation and wanting to be part of something, but also to get away from something.
Here, Josh talks about how we're a pattern of our conditioning and training, and that many people who gravitate toward Boulder Crest often have a difficult upbringing. And what he's talking about here are adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. Josh and Ken talk pretty extensively in their book about how they came to learn about ACEs research and how it impacted Boulder Crest's applied post-traumatic growth program. Here's an excerpt in the book that grabbed my attention. It's in chapter 3. Starts out with, "There were some thoughtful, interesting people who brought a different perspective to the table. They broadened their scope of what might be fueling struggle and seemed to get much better results. One of those people is Susie Landolfi, who got us interested in the role that adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, play in people's journey from struggle to strength." Side note for our listeners, Susie's bio is on the Boulder Crest website and highlights her current role as a senior path guide, an equine therapist, and a licensed marriage and family therapist in both California and Virginia. Back to the book. Susie had been doing work with the veterans in California and started to realize that soldiers' trauma often had more to do with what happened before they joined the military than what happened during their time of service, including war experiences. Susie examined what drove someone in the military in the first place and how these past experiences might continue to impact veterans after they stepped off the battlefield, end quote. For those not as familiar with ACEs, let me give some background. There's a famous ACE study that is one of the largest investigations of childhood abuse and neglect and later life health and well-being of its kind. You can find lots of good information on the CDC website about this study. One important finding to note is that as the number of ACEs in an individual's history, for example, child abuse, experiencing the death of a loved one at a young age, etc., as that number increases, so does the risk later in life for things like alcohol abuse, heart disease, poor academics, depression, illicit drug use, risk for intimate partner violence and sexual violence, financial stress, suicide attempts. The list goes on and on. If you want to learn more about the ACE study, visit this episode's webpage because we've linked to an August 2017 MFLN Family Development webinar where we were very fortunate to have Dr. Melissa Merrick, who serves as the lead scientist for the ACE study in the CDC, speak about the ACE study and its implications on health and wellness. That webinar recording is titled The Buffer Zone: What Adverse Childhood Experiences Study Teaches About Maximizing Health and Well-Being. Again, it'll be on today's podcast episode webpage. Okay, so let's continue back with the book excerpt in chapter 3. Josh and Ken go on to write that Susie's research-based approach seemed to produce the kind of deep, long-term healing they wanted to achieve. So we brought her in to work with us. Starting with her model, we began working through a diagram that looked at the positives and negatives from a person's upbringing. Immediately, it became apparent to everyone that the experience they had in childhood were directly linked to their current struggles. It didn't matter whether the current struggles related to issues of anxiety or depression, whether it was alcohol or drug abuse, domestic or sexual violence, relationship challenges, or any other issues. Consistently, there was a direct correlation between the experiences they had in their upbringing and what they were struggling with at the current moment. We began to really dig in, exploring the notion of childhood development, childhood trauma, and ACEs. The essential questions we were trying to answer were twofold. Why is it that people struggle? And why is it that some people can use their struggle to create strength and growth while other people can't? What great questions to ask. We'll link more info on research initiatives uncovering the prevalence of childhood adversity in military populations to today's podcast webpage as well. Now let's jump back to the conversation where Josh continues to talk about patterns observed with those that Boulder Crest serves, and also what we know about experiences that many military veterans go through.
And in the military, they found something that they didn't have before. And of course, these stories can vary, male to female, individuals, but as a general statement, that's what we see. And we often see a great sense of fulfillment and purpose and connection and a strong sense of identity in the military. Mm-hmm. And then what tends to happen is you get out, and the transition is really, really difficult because you start to have this destabilization. I don't know who I am anymore if I'm not a Marine. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my life. I don't know why I'm here. I don't know what my purpose is. And I certainly don't know who my tribe is. Right, I don't trust civilians. I don't know where to go. I don't know who to connect with. People feel superficial or false. And so that's the general sort of trajectory in the story we see over the course of time. And of course, within that, you hear as many stories as there are people. And the stories continue to amaze in terms of the capacity of this community and the insistence of this community on being of service and being of integrity.
And I'm sure inspires both you and Ken and just fuels your wanting to, you know, continue with this initiative and in these projects, undoubtedly. Yeah.
It does. And I think in part because our view, and my view as a civilian, Ken's view as someone who's in the Navy for almost 22 years, is that veterans, and specifically combat veterans and their family members, are different in all of the ways that we need in our nation. And we need leaders and strong people who have integrity and have a code and a moral compass. And so we look at it and think, you know, people come to Boulder Crest, it's beautiful, these places are beautiful, and we're like, this is not a monument to your service. Mm-hmm. It's a way station and a training ground for your next mission, mm-hmm. which is to be the father or the mother or the community member or mm-hmm. the clergy person who is of service and who is of strength. And that's part of what gets lost in this whole narrative about veterans is these men and women are amazing. They're amazing human beings.
Right.
And when we convince people that they're broken and that they're destined to live this diminished life, we destroy potential that isn't just, you know, destroying someone's life, but we also inhibit our communities from benefiting from it. Because when our veterans are strong, our nation's better. And that's always been true. We see it in D.C. We see it in state legislatures. We see it in, like, post-World War II, we saw it. And now we have the lowest percentage of representatives with military backgrounds that we've had. And so that's changing a little bit, but it's not enough. And so that's, like, the bigger picture here is we're not trying to help people feel less bad. We're trying to enable these men and women to be as productive at home as they were on the battlefield.
Right. And really being able to be vulnerable doesn't necessarily imply a lack of strength. And so struggling well helps on so many fronts. I'm curious, just with my background as a trained clinical family therapist, what are the impacts that you're seeing with this program, these initiatives, this curriculum on family dynamics? I mean, because you talked, and I'm putting words in your mouth, but a lot of what you talked about is this release of shame and guilt and an increase in hope that undoubtedly has tremendous impacts on families. But I'm curious what patterns you're seeing in the work that's being done at Boulder Crest.
Yeah, well, I kind of have two areas I can draw on. So our Warrior Path program, in August of 2016, we began a 18-month longitudinal program evaluation study conducted by Rich Sadesky and Brett Moore, who, if you don't know Brett, Brett's a twice-deployed military psychologist who's really kind of an expert in a lot of areas in this space and is just a great guy on top of it. And we now have I think 91% response rate at 18 months. We literally just got the 18-month responses on the last of the four pilots, and we're actually studying eight groups in two tranches. And one of the numbers that puts a gigantic smile on my face is that Warrior Path attendees, the students we call them, their couple satisfaction index goes up 50% and stays that way over the course of the 18 months, which for many of these folks who are in relationships or in marriages, it means that nothing changed except for them and their capacity to see their partner for who they really are and to tap that love and commitment and connection has renewed. And that, to me, is incredibly satisfying that we're having that kind of an impact. The other thing we know is that combat stress, whatever you want to call it, anxiety, stress, depression, all of those things are contagious. And when one person in a family is struggling, it has a significant effect on everybody else. And our Family Path program, and again, we've done three pilots, and of course, we've also spent time with thousands of families over the course of the last 5 years, is the core ailment that takes place in these families is disconnection. And it's just this sense of not everybody's on the same page, not even on the same team, and that affects the kids. Sometimes the kids are acting out, sometimes they're shutting down, sometimes they're trying to be bridge builders, sometimes they pick a parent. The relationship and the communication has really shut down in a lot of respects. And so in terms of being able to work with these entire families, it makes a significant impact. Mm-hmm. Because if somebody comes here and their family is in dire straits and they get better, but their family is kind of left where they were, that doesn't really do a lot to lift up the whole family and inevitably usually leads someone to come back down to where everybody else is. And so it's really important to us that we provide the practices and the training for the individual attendees to be able to go home and bring these practices, this clarity to their family, as well as to be able to work with the entire family, which is such an important part of this experience in which, obviously, you know, the VA is limited from providing those services, and I'm sure you've had plenty of exposure yourself.
Yes.
But it is a blessing to get to see kids return to being kids. To see them bond with each other and not want to leave, which we had some crying the other week when but we were like, no, you have to go home now. And they were like, we don't want to go home. I was like, I know you don't want to go home, but you can't stay here.
This is a part of the journey. Yeah. And that kind of touches on or is a complement to what you were talking about when people are struggling with trauma, when your foundation is rocked, when it's, you know, just push to the place where you don't feel safe, you know, what you knew before is no longer true for you. So that spills over onto families when their parent is struggling with that, children and also spouses and other family members, it impacts them. So it can
do a lot of destruction to their foundations and beliefs as well. So when you're able to integrate those family members into something that's working, you know, for their veteran parent, and it heals and it repairs in the way that helps the family thrive and function in a way that's going to be good for their future. So I was very happy to see not only that you had family involvement, but that you're looking towards the couple piece too. And am I right in thinking that you haven't started that yet, but you're on the verge?
We are. Well, and I think, you know, we try to go, and generally our development cycle for curriculum, because again, everything we're building, we're trying to create, you know, this curriculum that allows it to be scaled and allows other people to adopt it and allows people to understand that, that the stuff is proven. And so it made sense to start with the individual combat veteran and really, really deeply understand that. And then to leverage our understanding of the family and run the family program. And of course, within family programs, you have individuals, couples, an entire family unit, and of course the children. And then to be able to take what we're learning about the couples and then translate it over into a couples program. And as we continue to get to know better and better the language and the experience of the spouse, is to be able to then build that caregiver program. So the cool part is, it has a domino effect to it, but it also, it's infinitely easier to do the second one than it was the first one. We're trying to figure out what to do with a blank page. And it's infinitely easier to do three after you've done two and the caregiver after you've done the couple.
Right.
So we sort of are building our repository of understanding to do that. And I think, you know, when I look at times of struggle and I look at my own struggle, and it wasn't just that I didn't have good guides to go to, but it was also that I didn't have the language or a framework to understand what is it that I need to construct in my life to start to rebuild, to start to move forward, and you know, and what am I shooting at? And so all you're kind of left with when you're struggling is like, you know, just literally trying to make it minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day.
You're in survival mode. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, how do you open up and be met there and then be able to move kind of efficiently and effectively and respectfully through from, and I kind of was thinking the other day, like survival to then coping, which is like, okay, so now you're kind of living, but you've got these, you know, whatever you can do to keep it together. Then you move into living, which is, you know, good. And then you move into thriving. And so it's like, what does this journey look like? And stuff's going to happen that's going to rock your world because, you know, I could go through, let's just say, you know, my divorce is the worst thing. But the odds are I'm going to lose my parents at some point. They're 70 years old. They're in good health, but I can lose. So things will continue to happen. And the sad truth is we're never like done with our allotment of struggle. And so when you build a life that can sustain that, that can interpret it and understand it, then you don't personalize it and it doesn't overwhelm you again. And so Rich talks about the analogy for post-traumatic growth as an earthquake. And you look at New Orleans, and New Orleans was rocked, obviously, by Katrina, and Rita hit it hard. And so the city was in large part destroyed. And when they rebuilt it, and I think I had done some work on education in Louisiana in a past life, they committed to building a school system that was second to none. They built it better than it ever was because they had the chance to start over. And I think that's the analogy in our lives is you build it, and you have the floodplains of the better, and you have the different things you need to prevent it from happening again. And so that's the whole vision is how do you construct a life that is durable, sustainable, and authentic? And that's when you talk about vulnerability, which, you know, we talk about open and honest and courageous and kind of words like that to describe the importance of looking back to make sense of things, but not getting stuck there and not letting your past, you know, be a place for residence, but a place for reference to learn from and to move forward.
You know, Josh, my specializations in family trauma from a clinical perspective, and I've taught a lot of graduate courses on family trauma and how to work with individuals and couples and also families and children who have experienced trauma. And one of the illustrations that I give to students always is that you can't just dive right into healing, that there has to be some foundational things that you put into place to help ground people and so that healing then can occur or coping can occur in a different way than just them being in survival mode. And one of the illustrations that I provide is that, you know, if you think of the trauma and the experiences in maybe it's multiple traumas that have occurred as a tornado, what are we taught? If there's a tornado, you have to hold on or find something to ground you, whether it's a pipe that's deep in the, you know, and so you hold on to that so that no matter what the strength of the chaos that's ensuing around you, you have that foundational grounding. And we talk about that a lot. And I think that the illustration that you just provided from Tedeschi and Dr. Calhoun with the Katrina and the or earthquakes and natural disasters too. It's interesting that we're all going in the natural disaster route for our trauma illustrations. But anyway, that one definitely speaks to me. I might be borrowing that in the near future.
Well, and you know, it's a couple of things that are really interesting. One that they didn't account for when they looked at kind of what post-traumatic growth was about that we take very seriously here, which is this idea of having a safe and trusted environment.
Right.
And we know about, you know, they call it therapeutic milieu, and these ideas of environment matters and the people in the environment matters. And so Tedeschi and Brett Moore studied it, and they told us that, you know, there's four things that create that here. There's the philosophy of post-traumatic growth, which is hopeful, and you guys meet people where they are. You don't mm-hmm. treat people, as this one woman said, who came through our program, a female combat veteran, I expected you to treat me as PTSD Jane, mm-hmm. and you never did, right? You never spoke to me like I was a broken foot. And the second is the program, so really thoughtful, comprehensive, post-traumatic growth-based programming. And then the other two, one was place, which is, you know, our places are in mountains. They're physically, they feel safe, they look mm-hmm. safe, and they're beautiful. And the wood that we have is strong, and it can hold things. Mm-hmm. And the last are the people, which is, it's people who are incredibly committed to the well-being and the possibility in the future of the folks who come to us, as well as people who aren't afraid to be honest and open with our own stories. And so that environment is super important. And that connection, and we know for some people with a high dropout rate in this community for mental health is they go in and they find they don't connect well with often civilian providers. And I think that one of the things that's important to us is to build that connection. And Carl Rogers obviously wrote a ton about this mm-hmm. idea of being both empathetic but also being congruent and honest and open, mm-hmm. but really focusing not just on what you have to do as a protocol, but also how you're doing it and mm-hmm. who you are and how you're engaging and connecting. And the other part of that is a major part of everything we do here are when you say grounding, we talk about regulation practices. So things like meditation and breathing techniques and walking in nature, those things that get you to a place of calm to do difficult stuff.
And mindfulness.
Because we know, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I want to also touch on your book, Struggle Well, too. I haven't finished reading all of it, I have to admit. But from what I have read, a lot of it was written for those that are in the midst of the struggle or have struggled with various types of symptoms that you've already discussed today. However, I really thought that this is a good read that can benefit family members, but also helping professionals, whether they be mental health clinicians or in advocacy roles, service professionals that work with military families. I mean, it's just anyone who's connected to those that are suffering. What was your vision and or Ken Falk's vision and hope with regard to the type of audience that you could have and reach with this particular book?
You know, we, and I appreciate you saying that, and I think that when we, Ken and I are out on the road a lot, and we're out on the road meeting with donors to raise money, we're meeting with policymakers and staffers and other nonprofits and just regular people, just, you know, in the course of our day-to-day life. And the number of times that either someone pulled us into a private room to tell us something really, really awful that had happened to them, that, you know, they would preface it and say, well, I've never told anyone this, but I feel like I need to tell you, and, you know, I was molested by a priest or whatever it was, or who grab our arm, who grab us on the forearm, and they'd say, you know, I or someone in my family or someone I care about deeply, they need to go through this program, but they're not a veteran, mm-hmm. and can you help them? Mm-hmm. And so Ken and I were like, you know, how do we scale and leverage what we know, recognizing that the needs of this community are such that we can't just serve, you know, anybody. That's just not, that's not on the cards. These places are for, you know, combat veterans and first responders and their families and Gold Star families. And so we got to thinking about it. We're like, well, you know, what makes the most sense is we have a good understanding and a pretty clear idea of what we're doing and why it works and how it works. We should sit down and at least we can offer somebody something that speaks to what we've learned and kind of the journey that we've been on and the journey that we think we want to cultivate and facilitate for other people. So the vision really was, how do we provide something in places we can't be or that can substitute for us and allow people to experience this? And we've gotten, you know, when you do this sort of thing, I mean, it probably took us a year to write it. And it was an incredible process, a really joyous process, and you kind of have a great relationship, and you really get to see the things you agree on and disagree on, and it wasn't much that we disagreed on, and to get the feedback from lots of different people and lots of different worlds, from veterans to spouses to the churchgoers to, you know, just random people, friends who I thought read the book just because I wrote it, mm-hmm. and who like needed it. And so to me, I hope that what we did was to, in the most unacademic way, to clearly articulate and lay out what is the journey of post-traumatic growth look like, what does it require, and what does it enable, and how do you support other people through that journey. And I think our hope is, you know, there's no limit on who might be able to benefit or at least to start a conversation or to shift a perspective, because, you know, you can't change what happened. You can certainly change how you view what happened in your life and what the point of it was and what you're meant to take from it and learn from it and grow from it. And so, but that was the genesis. It was all of these folks who weren't eligible for our program saying, help us. And that was our sort of, you know, the best thought we had was as a starting point, was to try to write down in words using our stories to articulate that journey.
Right. Well, and I've said this quite a few times in this podcast, I don't know if our audience is tired of hearing it, but one of my favorite quotes is, when you shift the way you see things, the things you see change. And certainly this program and this way of shifting in order to get to a place of healing and having the life you want, despite the tremendous pain and suffering and struggle that you've gone through, is incredibly empowering. And I'm really excited that we were able to meet you and organize you coming today. I'm also really happy that you talked about retired U.S. Navy Captain Charlie Plum, who wrote the foreword for the book. He had quite a few powerful experiences to share, and I really enjoyed his story. So, along with a lot of the other, you know, stories that I'm reading in the book. So, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us today that we didn't address or cover?
I think the last thing I'd probably say is, as I'm a bit of a quote junkie, and I like what you just shared, is there's a quote from Arthur Schopenhauer, and he said that we mistake the limits of the world for the limits of our own field of vision. And in other words, if we can't see something, we can't achieve it. We can't reach for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm mindful in this world of labels and of diagnoses, mm-hmm. and things that remind us of all the things we can't do and all the limits that are put on us, is really to not let other people put limits on your life, and to recognize that as James Stockdale, who was in the Hanoi Hilton for 6.5 years, talked about, is that struggling, and in struggling well, we are part of a long line of people who've gone before us, and we're not unique in our journeys, even though at times it feels very isolating and very unique, mm-hmm. is that we're part of a long line of people, and there's a lot of wonderful wisdom in the world and books and in other people to share, because few people escape life without going through their struggles of different kinds and varieties. And the most important part in that is that we support each other on that journey, whether we're professionals or otherwise. And that motto of the Hanoi Hilton of "you are your brother's keeper," I think, is one of the things that's true to this military and veteran community, and something we should all do well to remember, is we are all capable of impacting other people in positive and negative ways. And we all have the ability to support and guide another person through the journey of post-traumatic growth. And I'd encourage everyone to take that responsibility seriously and positively.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. Josh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you today.
If you are interested in learning more about post-traumatic growth, please join our family development team along with the military caregiving and family transitions teams for our 2-part webinar, Opportunities and Possibilities, Post-Traumatic Growth in Research and Practice. Part 1 will take place on July 18th, 2018 at 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time and will be presented by Dr. Richard Tedeschi of UNC Charlotte, who Josh referenced many times throughout this episode. Part 2 will take place on August 8th at 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time and will be a continuation of our conversation on post-traumatic growth through a facilitated discussion from panelists including Richard Tedeschi,
Josh Goldberg, and Karen Crinsley with the National Center for PTSD, VA Boston Healthcare System. You can find out more information about these webinars by going to militaryfamilieslearningnetwork.org/event/22082 and militaryfamilieslearningnetwork.org/event/21552. You can also find the links to these webinars on this podcast episode's webpage. If you are unable to attend these sessions live, they will both be available for archive viewing. We hope you'll join us.
Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you'd like to hear more episodes from Anchored, check out the links provided on our website, or you can go directly to iTunes. Just enter MFLN Anchored Podcast in your search engine to get you there. We offer continuing education credits for most of our programming. Information about that can be found on our website, or you can just email our team at mflnfamilydevelopment@gmail.com. We hope you will join us next time. This material is based on work supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy. U.S. Department of Defense award number is 2015-48770-24368.